Hi, everyone. Welcome to the first edition of the Safe Travels podcast. My name is Joey. I'm currently at Grand Canyon National Park here at my campground. And this morning, I had the opportunity to sit down with Jason Nez, who is a fire archaeologist here at the park, and he's also part of Navajo Nation. We had a great candid conversation about the rich cultural history here at the park, and we also talked about the details of his job as a fire archaeologist. We have a lot to talk about. Your job is incredibly fascinating. And, you know, the goal of this podcast is really to teach current visitors and future visitors all about the canyon and how to view it in different ways and, you know, what makes the canyon special. And I think something that's really unique to me about Grand Canyon is when you look at it, you're looking at an open Facebook of geological history from the rocks at the bottom being billions of years old to standing on 250 million year old rock at the top. But beyond that, there's a lot of cultural history that I want to talk about with you and a lot of stories that are buried in that rock and can be seen in that rock as well. So I just want to start there and talk about, you know, some of the culture that exists within the park and the native history that exists within Grand Canyon.
Yeah, so here at Grand Canyon, we have what we can prove with physical evidence is over 12,000 years of human occupation. So we have artifacts dating back to the Clovis period, about 12,000 BC. And most recently, there was an exciting find in White Sands where they found footprints that were that dated back to 23,000 years ago. So now we have an older culture out there that's 12,000 years before Clovis. And I think that right now we're sort of scientists, archaeologists, we're trying to figure out what the markers are, what the artifact assemblage might be from this older culture. But definitely the indigenous occupation of Grand Canyon goes back to time immemorial.
I saw this video of you talking about when you view the Grand Canyon, you view ancestries from life to death to what you just mentioned, the artifacts that you find in the rocks. What are ways that visitors, when they come to Grand Canyon, can pay respect to that and understand that they're on a living memoriam for a lot of special, you know, ancestries?
I think that a lot of visitors, when they come here, they need to change their mindset. The Grand Canyon isn't just this awesome and beautiful geologic feature. It's not just a place full of natural wonders like birds and other animals. And it's not even just a place of plants. It's a place of human connections. And I think that when we try to separate all of the little things that make up what the Grand Canyon is, we tend to confuse it. When we compartmentalize it, it becomes a distraction because we're constantly focused on that. But I think that if visitors were able to embrace sort of our indigenous way of looking at things, which is everything is connected, everything is holistic. In Navajo, it's hajon, nejone, everything is beautiful and everything is balanced. So when we think of the Grand Canyon and other places like this as balanced and beautiful, we think of everything as a whole rather than focus on just what's in front of us. And when we think of nature that way, we incorporate all of the human connections and all of the animal connections, and that enhances it and it makes it stronger. And then when you come and look at this place, you're not just seeing this amazing canyon, you're seeing all of the human connections, all of our culture, all of our language, all of our religion from time immemorial. All of it you take in with just one look, with just a few seconds of being quiet and listening to the canyon on the edge. You'll hear birds, you'll hear people, you'll hear all of the sounds of nature, but you're also hearing this lifetime of indigenous use and indigenous occupation here.
How would you recommend for people coming to the Grand Canyon to invest or educate themselves prior to getting to the canyon so that when they do arrive here, and they do look out on the canyon, they do recognize everything you had just mentioned?
I think there's a lot of ways that people can get ready for coming here. And for me, as an Indigenous American, I advocate to people, like, you know, stop by your nearest reservation, stop by your neighbors. You probably have indigenous neighbors, and they'll give you some insight into how to experience a place like this. And to me, that's the only way, because you can't learn it from a book. You can't learn it from a TV show. It's something that you have to experience.
When we talk about the history and the culture of indigenous tribes that have existed and continue to exist in Grand Canyon National Park, you know, there's always a, you know, a tough story to tell behind that. And when the Grand Canyon became a national park in the early 1900s, how did that affect the tribes, and how does that continue to affect the tribes today?
So a lot of what happened in the past is very traumatic for a lot of indigenous peoples. We're over 300 years since Columbus arrived. We're over 200 years since the American government was established and all of the things that have happened since. And those traumas aren't just personal experiences, they're passed down. We have parents and grandparents that went to boarding schools and they were forced to unlearn a lot of the things they learned. And we were encouraged to leave our traditions behind, leave our language behind, and leave our culture behind. And that struggle to reconnect comes out in different ways. It comes out in low self-esteem. It comes out in alcoholism. It comes out with domestic violence. All of those negative things are the result of this past trauma and exclusion. And here at Grand Canyon, a lot of our tribes were removed from this area starting in the late 1800s. And that exclusion of indigenous use and indigenous occupation has led to this massive, unhealthy fuel buildup. It led to the potential for catastrophic fires that didn't used to occur. And that's just a result of us not being here. And later on in the late 1800s, the Navajo, we were removed from the Desert View area in 1897 by the Coconino County Sheriff's Posse, Ralph Cameron, who in the old days of this park, they idolized him. They talk about him. Ralph Cameron did this, Ralph Cameron did that. And when in reality, he was a criminal. He was a walking crime against humanity. And then later on, even into the 1900s or the early 1900s, Park Service people burned down the Havasupai village that was within the park boundary. And that's another great trauma that's still close. So we deal with all these things every day, every time we come here, and we look for ways to move past it. We look for ways to avoid repeating those mistakes. And I think that it's heavy on a lot of people's minds when they come here.
The tribes that were forced out of Grand Canyon, where do they relocate, and how difficult is that to relocate when you have generations of people who have learned to farm on these lands and gather resources on these lands? And when you put them in a new location, how difficult has that been for those tribes to leave the park and relearn?
Yeah, so it's this ongoing issue that indigenous people face. We're trying to reconnect. We're trying to find those relationships that we once had that we lost when we were moved out. The Havasupai people were moved down to Supai Village down in the Grand Canyon and limited to just 500 acres. The whole tribe was limited there. The Navajos were forced on to our reservation, and the Hopis that were using the area were forced onto their reservations. The Paiutes in the north were forced way out of the area. So it's not just my tribe. It's this collective exclusion and trauma that we're dealing with.
I do want to go back to something you said earlier about when tribes left the Grand Canyon, it left a massive gap for explosive fires to go on within the canyon. Can you elaborate on that and, you know, how that process occurs?
So in my job as a fire archaeologist, working with our fire management program to help facilitate fuel reductions to keep our community safe, to help facilitate prescribed fires, to help keep the environment safe. And the unfortunate reality is that with the exclusion of Native people, Indigenous people to the reservations, it left this gap in the environment that's led to this imbalance. And that imbalance is this fuel buildup. A park like Grand Canyon here in the South Rim, we should have 20 to 30 trees an acre, but we probably have 200 to 300 trees an acre or more. So we've created a very dense tree density that's unhealthy for the trees that are there now. And with climate change, any fire that gets into it tends to be too hot. It tends to be catastrophic. And that's a direct result of Indigenous people being excluded. And it continues now with the further exclusion with our laws and policies that don't reflect 23,000 years, time immemorial of human occupation. Without us, the environment becomes sick and unhealthy. It needs us back. It needs Indigenous people using this landscape and its resources in the way we've done for over 23,000 years now.
Has the Grand Canyon made strides in that area to include Indigenous people in resources and occupations like this within the park?
Yeah, I'm proud of the way this park has moved forward. Nothing's going to be perfect. Nothing that anyone does is going to make up for all of the bad things that have happened. But we've taken those steps to include Indigenous interpretation, include Indigenous stories, and actually give us sort of this footing back in the canyon to be able to tell our history, our culture, and the way we see fit at places like Desert View, at places around the park. We're changing the information on kiosks. We've renamed Indian Gardens to Havasupai Gardens to reflect their close cultural ties that go back a long time. So yeah, I think we're making great steps forward, and I think that we'll be a model for other parks around the country.
I'm glad you mentioned Desert View, because Desert View is a point of emphasis for the Grand Canyon right now and developing that area into an area of resource for visitors to come and learn about Indigenous people and the tribes that have existed and continue to exist within the Grand Canyon. How important is that for the Grand Canyon to invest in an area like that where visitors can congregate and learn from tribal members themselves? There's 11 tribes that are included in the planning of this project.
I think it's super important because all of our parks, our recreation areas, our forest service, we've compartmentalized people out of the picture. And when we overemphasize nature, important and beautiful as it is, when we overemphasize the animals, when we overemphasize the trees, we're excluding this human and environmental relationship. And when we leave humans out of it, when we don't talk about them, when we don't acknowledge them, we forget about them. And all of a sudden, we have these unhealthy landscapes. But when we bring humans back into the story at places like Desert View, we're reestablishing relationship. We're reestablishing balance with the environment, which is going to become critical as things change in the environment. As the climate becomes hotter, as we have less and less water, we're going to have to look back on lessons from our ancestors to learn how to survive. We're going to have to look to this relationship that we've underrepresented, and we're going to have to start learning how to talk about it. We're going to have to start learning how to incorporate all of that, what we call traditional ecological knowledge that's out there.
My time being here at the Grand Canyon this week, it amazes me looking out into the canyon and how breathtakingly large it is, and some of the hikes going down, just knowing that I have to climb all the way back out. Yeah. And then it puts everything more into perspective when I think about this conversation that we have, the people who have lived here, as you mentioned, over 20,000 years ago, and you're continuing to find evidence of human life that predates anything that we can memorialize. And so, we have to encourage listeners and people who visit the park to remember that when they visit Grand Canyon, to invest in the human culture, as you just mentioned, and to put human to land here. I remember I watched in the documentary Voices of the Canyon that the canyon is living. It's a living place for a lot of people. And so when you, simple as kicking rocks or littering, you're disrespecting thousands of years of heritage and culture that people have called home. Can you speak to that? And, you know, people when they do visit and respecting, you know, the land that they're walking on?
Yeah. So when we look at a place like the Grand Canyon, when we can change the way we think about it and start thinking about it as alive, we can look at our impacts and we can see the pain and hardships we're causing, not just to the canyon, but the people that associate with this place. When we litter, when we damage the environment here, we're damaging people with a close cultural connection. We're damaging people's self-esteem. When we take care of this place, we take care of the people that come from this place. This place is a part of many tribes' DNA. It's part of our spirituality. It's part of our religion. What happens to this place happens to us. And what happens to us happens to this place. So a lot of indigenous people, we take care of ourselves to take care of places like this, and vice versa. We take care of this place. I do my job to the best of my ability. I'm taking care of not just my own people, but indigenous people and people around the world.
I'm glad you said that, because that's what I wanted to talk about next, is your impact on the Grand Canyon and your specific role in preserving these archaeological sites and the findings of tribal history and indigenous people. Can you go into your specific role? Fire archaeology is a really unique title.
So as an indigenous person, like a lot of indigenous tribes throughout the country, we recognize the natural processes that it takes to have a healthy environment. We recognize the need for floods. We recognize the need for rains. We recognize the need for fire. There's a lot of mistakes that managers have taken in the past, and part of those mistakes has been the exclusion of fire. And part of my job is facilitating the reintroduction of fire to the landscape, to the reintroduction of healthy fire to restore the balance that's out there. So I look at the landscapes and I identify resources that we need to protect for compliance with federal law. Using my cultural background, using my scientific education in environmental science, and using my experience as an archaeologist helps me help managers make a better decision when it comes to prescribed fire. Should we burn or should we not burn? And I can say we got this many sites out there, and three of those need fuel reductions, they need treatment, they need shelter wrap. So we'll go take care of that so we can have this fire and help keep the environment healthy. And that's been a lot of my role here. And I think that I take great pride in it, because it helps take care of resources that are out there, and it helps take care of the environment. And everyone wins when we start restoring these balances.
You talked about the decision-making and the process on which sites you burn and which sites you don't. Can you take us through the process of what a healthy burn actually looks like? How do you start that process? How do you end the process?
So we're always pre-planning here in the park. And part of that is identifying certain units or blocks that we're going to burn within, like, 5 years, we're going to burn this unit, 10 years, we're going to burn this unit. And part of my job is looking at those units and determining, do we know what's out there? Do we have enough survey coverage? Do we need to put boots on the ground and go out, implement some survey to see what's out there so that we can protect it? And when we know what's out there, then we're able to provide information to say, hey, we got 25 sites in this unit. Of those 20, three are fire sensitive. So we just need to take care of three. And the remaining sites have burned multiple times in past fires over the past 300 years, 1200 years, 2300 years. And a lot of our sites actually need fire to stay healthy. We don't think of sites as living, but for a lot of indigenous people, even our cultural sites, what we call archaeological sites, they need the same things that we need. They need water. They need fire. So fire comes in, it burns off the fuel buildup. So all of the fires afterwards are going to be light. It's just going to be burning through the grass, and the fire will be over within 30 minutes. But if we have an unhealthy buildup on top of those sites, the fire can burn for hours, if not days, and it can burn intensely. That intense heat can cause discoloration of artifacts. It can cause structures to burn. It can cause the soil to change, and it can have all manner of adverse effects that we got to look at. So when we find these sites and we know they're out there, we can go out, we can remove the fuels, we can look at the different options, we can cut line around it, we can station a fire engine there with water so we can put the fire out if it gets too hot. But for me, I'm looking at these sites and recognizing that they need fire, so I want us to be able to burn as close as we can to get rid of that fuel so that the next fire, the chances of it impacting the site are going to be a lot less.
We talk about the fires that the Grand Canyon manages, but what about natural fires that occur, whether it be from a lightning strike or something within the park? What's your role in that?
So during the summer fire season, the monsoons, when we start to get multiple lightning strikes per day, we're always looking at the potential to manage one, what we call a wildfire use fire. So when we have a wildfire use fire, what we call a WUFU, we'll look at the area and see if it's part of a plan. So let's say we want to burn in 2 years in this unit, and we'll look at that. We'll see what resources we have out there and make a determination. Okay, we're going to let this fire burn naturally within these boundaries. It probably won't get that big, but we'll be monitoring it. We'll be keeping an eye on it. We'll bring in wildfire use module, people that specialize in coming out and dealing with those things. And I'll work with those crews. I'll be out on the fire. If we have to dig any lines or do any prep work, I'll be checking for resources. I'll be checking our survey data to see what might be affected and helping managers, like, okay, the same thing I do with prescribed fire. We got this many sites. This is what it's going to take to protect them. I can get it done with a crew of five in like 5 days or a week and help them make better decisions too. And in addition to cultural resources, I also get a lot of information from our science center here in the park. So I'm getting input from wilderness recreation specialists, from wildlife specialists, from our hydrologists, all of that information to say, okay, we shouldn't burn this area. We shouldn't burn this area. The birds are nesting. It's breeding season. Like, factors like that start to come in, and we incorporate that into our fire management plans too.
That's amazing. You talk about, you know, indigenous artifacts in the mm-hmm. Grand Canyon. How does that play a role in your fire management? I saw in your office you have the map with all the sites.
Yeah.
So how does that play a role with the fire
burns? We've, over the past decade, we've developed the information we use to help us make fast decisions. So we've identified a lot of our fire-sensitive resources, which can be rock art panels, it can be old hogans, old sweat lodges, brush structures, it can be historic camps that are out there that meet the values that define it as a cultural resource site. And we have those identified. And we have our plans to whatever kind of work they need. So on my map, it says we need to dig a line around it. We need to apply water or foam, or we need to reduce the fuels around it or wrap it with shelter wrap. So all of that information is there already. And all of our pre-planning helps us make a fast decision, and it helps reduce stress and increases the safety for people on the ground too.
I found it interesting that even some of the decisions that you make are what's underground too. So if you were to have a bulldozer out there respecting the land that might be a memorial or might have artifacts of history.
Yeah, and part of the decision-making process is knowing how artifacts can be affected. A lot of our cultural resources there, fire adapted. They're fire resilient. There's sherds on the ground. There's lithics on the ground that have burned repeatedly. Here at the south rim of the Grand Canyon, we have a 7 to 10 year fire return interval. So for the past 12,000 years, we've probably been getting a fire every 10 years. So in 100 years, we've had 10 fires. In 1,000 years, we've had 100 fires. And that's what keeps the sites healthy. So recognizing that a lot of our sites burn and our sites need fire, it allows natural fire to move across the landscape and not have to create more disturbances by digging lines around rooms, trying to dig line around every artifact, but recognizing fire is going to help these sites in the long term. And we recognize that here in the park, and we allow a lot of natural fires to occur. And in other areas like the forest, they'll be using other techniques to contain fires, bulldozers and hand lines. And their archaeologists, I often work with them a lot, and we'll be out making sure that those ground disturbances don't impact the sites. Fire isn't going to impact the site, but a bulldozer will, a retardant drop will. So not just in this area, but around the country, other archaeologists, other fire archaeologists are working within those parameters of how fire can affect the sites and how suppression can affect the sites and what it's going to take to allow healthy fire to happen.
As it pertains to visitors, campers, hikers, mm-hmm. Do you see much fire starting from the campgrounds here, or what are precautionary steps that visitors can take to make sure that they're not adding to what could be eventually a dangerous fire in the future?
Yeah, here in the park, our current laws and regulations say we can only have campfires in developed areas. And one of the reasons we limit camping to the developed areas is that so we don't have these adverse impacts to the environment. Having people just camp anywhere causes the animals to be stressed. It causes stress on the local resources, and it raises the chances of a wildfire, someone's campfire getting away or something like that. So part of managing a park like this is determining where people can camp and where they can't camp. So we ask that people stay within those areas and adhere to the rules regarding campfires and all that.
I know when it comes to hikers and going off trail, mm-hmm. can be play a significant impact in erosion and erode the surface of the park even faster than maybe naturally.
Yeah.
Does going off trail as a hiker, does that maybe aid fires in terms of moving soil or eroding soil in areas that it shouldn't be?
Yeah, any type of movement on the landscape starts to cause impacts to natural and cultural resources. And here in the park, we want people to stay on the trails. We want people to stay within those already impacted areas. And that's what it's going to take to help preserve and protect the environment.
How many active archaeological dig sites are there within the park from like a human history cultural standpoint?
So we don't have any excavations going on right now. And the Park Service, as with any federal unit, we have consultation with the different tribes. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our tribes, it's our determination that any excavation would have an adverse impact to the site itself, acknowledging that the site is alive and it has deep cultural connections. So tribes like my tribe, the Navajo tribe, we ask that people just leave things alone. Mm-hmm. And they're better left alone for our own reasons. And yeah. I think a lot of tribes have a similar attitude. But when we do have an excavation, like one we had 10 years ago, what we call the Grand Archaeology Project, which was a series of excavations on the Colorado River, we had input from the different tribes. Tribes were able to come in and participate. They were able to look at the artifacts and give their input and give their interpretation of things. So we're able to work together to save these sites from erosion. And ultimately, that was why the excavation occurred, was because these sites were eroding away. So we're able to work together and preserve these sites and protect them for the future.
When it comes to fire and the tribes that currently live within the Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. how does your team in the Grand Canyon support them when they're faced with a fire or when they need to do a controlled burn of their own?
So even though I work here in the park and we have resources in the park, we have a Helitech crew, we have a wildland crew, we also help the different agencies and the tribes around us. So we're able to respond to fires on the Havasupai Reservation to our west, and we can also respond to fires on the Navajo Reservation to the east. And on the North Rim, we have areas that are associated with the Paiute tribes. So when we're managing and fighting fires up there, we're protecting their resources too. So that's just within our region, but nationally, all of us, our engines, helicopter, and our fellow resource advisors and archaeologists, we respond to fires throughout the country, and we bring our experience and our knowledge to fires in California, Oregon, and New Mexico. So it's not just this area that we're working in. We're also helping out across the country.
You alluded to it a little earlier, but I find it fascinating that when there is a fire, whether it's a controlled burn or a naturally caused fire, that there's a team that specializes in various areas of the burn. So I was reading that, there might be someone who specializes in tree and grass controlled burns,
yeah.
Someone in more towards water. And as that fire starts to approach different ecosystems, they'd be able to give better input on how to stop it or how to navigate it. Can you talk a little bit about that process and who goes into getting selected, who goes to each site?
Yeah, so throughout the country, we have different incident management teams that work in specific areas, areas that are timber, areas that are grassland, areas that are mixed wildland-urban interface, which is where houses are built into the trees in areas that burn. And the teams are made of people from all of the different disciplines, people that specialize in structure fire, wildland fire, and people that specialize in the resources to a particular area. And as fire season gets going, these teams will go throughout the country, deal with those resources in those areas, facilitate suppressing or managing the fires, and consulting with local units, their resource specialists. Grand Canyon, what kind of birds do you have out here? Grand Canyon, what kind of fish do you have out here? And how is this fire going to affect them? And how do we mitigate those effects?
Well, your role certainly fills a lot of stuff in terms of, work within the Grand Canyon and preserving, historic sites and working to educate visitors that come to the Grand Canyon. What's one, final thing that you want to give to visitors when they visit the park, whether it be from a resource standpoint or from an education culture standpoint?
Yeah, I think that the best way that people can help us protect a park like this is to learn about it, to engage with it, to come here and experience with it. And I think that's the best thing they can do with it. They can come here and see natural processes at work. They can come here and experience the indigenous connections we have to this place. And that's the best thing they can do for it.
Finally, I just want to give you a moment to talk about what personally Grand Canyon means to you in your life and what it continues to mean to you every day.
So a lot of my connection to the canyon goes way back to when I was a kid growing up on the Navajo Reservation at this place called Coal Mine Mesa. And where I grew up, you can see the canyon in profile every day. At night, the sun sets behind the Grand Canyon. During the day, I can see South Rim, I can see North Rim for most of my life. And growing up, my grandmother was a very traditional person, and she would refer to this place as this emergence place. And knowing that, hearing that all my life, I recognize that the Grand Canyon is an emergence place. It's an emergence place for some of our Navajo clans. It's an emergence place for some of our neighboring tribes, and it has the same value that we would give to a human mother. That same value, that same connection, we also give to the Grand Canyon. And that's one of the reasons why we go out and we protect and preserve this place to the best of our abilities.
Was there a turning point in your life where you knew that the Grand Canyon was the place that you wanted to protect and preserve?
I think I've always known that and felt that. And for me, being an archaeologist, looking back at time, I've seen and learned about the different threats to this place. The mining that they wanted to do here, the dams they wanted to do here, and most recently, this Escalade project where they wanted to build this tram into the canyon. And before my employment here with the park, one of my prouder moments that I look back that I'll always talk about is helping the local families fight against that development. And not just local families, but also the associated tribes, and helping them keep this great desecration from happening. And I've recognized that my place in this world is going to be protecting and preserving places like this because of those deep cultural connections, because I recognize that this place is the mother of some of our clans and the mother of some of our tribes, and I would protect it accordingly.
Yeah, that's amazing. We could talk forever, but you just mentioned some of the projects that would have directly affected Grand Canyon and the history of its people and, the canyon effectively of itself. And, I think when people come here, especially first time visitors to any national park, you think of ease of access. I want to see the Colorado River, but I can't from most of the rim, right? You can, mm-hmm. You can see parts of it at Desert View. But when you talk about projects like that, the Escalade project that might maybe enhance access to the park.
Yeah.
What are the cons of that? I know you alluded to a little bit, but there's a reason why those projects can't exist within the park while also keeping the purity of the park and the health of the park alive.
So management has changed over the past 100 years since the inception of the Park Service and the Forest Service. At one time, managing a park used to be, we need to build hotels. We need to make visitation easy. We need to be able to bring thousands, hundreds of people here a day. We need to have animals for them to pet. We need to have people here to serve them. But over time, we've evolved to this more natural viewpoint of visitation, that to come here, you need to experience it. You need to experience the heat. You need to experience the struggle of hiking in and out. You need to experience the viewscape, the soundscape, and to some extent, the smellscape even. And until you experience all of those, you're never going to truly experience this place. And I think that now we recognize that part of that experience is part of what makes this place special. And when we do crazy things like building trams, building mines in the canyon, building mines near the canyon, it distracts from that. Mm-hmm. It removes that experience that we owe everyone in this world when they come here.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. And to your point, I've tried the Bright Angel and the South Kaibab Trail. They are difficult. You really feel the canyon when you're doing those trails.
When you work here long enough, like just hiking up and down, to me, it's like, put my headphones on, I'll be on top in 3 hours and I'll be fine.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah. Well, Jason, thank you so much for the time. It's been an absolute pleasure. Your story is incredible. Your work here is amazing. So thank you for everything that you do for the people who visit here and everything you do to connect people, with the ancestry of the canyon and the tribes that have existed and continue to exist here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And thanks everyone for listening. And come in and enjoy your park.
Thanks for checking out this edition of the Safe Travels podcast. It was such a joy getting to learn from Jason Nez. And if you enjoy this type of content, make sure to like, comment, and subscribe wherever you're listening or watching from, as it really does help out our channel. And until next time, safe travels.